So welcome. My name is Lori Hansen. I'm a member of the Education Committee here to introduce the two presenters today for the SNA ARM chat on the ACA. Presenters are Patricia Nelson-Reed, an SNA member from Maine, and Benji Rubin, an SNA member from Illinois. And there are two PowerPoints. One is entitled SNA ARM Chat on ACA December 2014. You can download that. That's for Benji's part of the presentation. And the first part of the presentation will be Patty's ACA Expanded Medicaid Armchair Chat. That's what the document is called, so pull that down. And with that, I'll Patty, one more thing to tell everybody is to mute your line, *6, because we can hear everybody. And Patty, why don't you start and let people know if you want them to interrupt you or wait for you to give your talk, and then they can ask questions. So, Patty.
Hello, everybody from Northern Maine or Southern Maine. Whichever, my sense is it may be better for us to do our discussion and then ask questions, because it's too difficult to see who has a question since we can't see any hands raised. But if someone feels it's very burning, feel free to interrupt in the meantime. Otherwise, we are going to have 15 or 20 minutes for questions at the end and comments also. So initially, I wanted to just give a big perspective of the ACA, which is probably repetitive for a lot of you, but just in case, understanding that there's basically three different areas that the ACA is addressing. One area is the consumer protections that are found in health insurance contracts. Second is the access to medical insurance. And third is the expansion of Medicaid for low-income individuals. And the purposes of all these three are to make good insurance or relatively good insurance available to most of America. In regard to consumer protections, there was the consumer protections are mandatory, and they started in 2010 and continued through 2014. So in 2010, the initial prohibition was that all insurance contracts could not have a lifetime coverage for what's considered essential health benefits, and there's 10 essential health benefits, and we'll go over them a little later. In 2010, the initial statute prohibited denial of children for pre-existing conditions. This was expanded as part of the statute to all people as of 2014. In 2014, for individual and small groups, insurers are now prohibited from charging higher rates due to gender or health status. Age is authorized, but gender and health status cannot alter a premium. And finally, there was in 2014 a prohibition of the annual dollar limit on the total amount of coverage for essential health benefits. So now there's no lifetime limit and there's no annual limit for these 10 essential health benefits. In regard to access to medical insurance, we've seen that a lot in 2014, and that's really dealing with the individual mandate that if a person does not qualify for an exemption, then individuals must pay a penalty if they fail to purchase health insurance. I was trying to figure out how this was going to be enforced, because this is actually the first year in 2014 that's effective. And in the draft 1040, there's a new line 62, which is called, I think it's called personal responsibility or something to that effect. And that line is for people to pay the penalty if they failed to insure themselves. I don't think it has a lot of teeth at this point, but it's there. It's a matter of, I think, self-reporting.
Yeah, it's rougher. It's, what do they call it? They won't give you a refund, basically. They'll take it away from your refund. I think that's what I heard.
Okay. You have to self-report that you don't have the insurance, because they don't really know whether you have the insurance or not. In regard to major changes we've all seen are these exchanges that offer ACA insurance coverage. These exchanges are computer exchanges. They're not places where people go to visit. They're different websites. They're managed by either the federal government or managed by the state at the state's option. They could manage them themselves. And the exchanges offer coverage that meets certain the criteria that are required for all ACA coverages. They meet them. And there's four different levels of it. It's bronze through platinum, and then there is also catastrophic insurance only available for people, I believe it's under the age of 30. And the level of insurance all depends on the percentage of cost sharing. So the bronze insurance, which becomes relevant, and I'll explain that a little bit, but the bronze insurance is 60% is the insurance, and 40% is the insured. That's the cost sharing. And it gradually goes up through platinum and gold and platinum and silver. Silver is the 70%. Gold is the 80%, and the platinum amount is 90%. So platinum, higher quality insurance, 90% of the risk would be borne, or the cost sharing would be borne by the insurance, and 10% by the insured. The ACA, a huge benefit to people, instituted the tax credit for persons with modified adjusted gross income between 100% to 400%. So those individuals who apply for insurance on the exchange, if they have, if their modified adjusted gross income is 100%, they're going to get a large tax credit. And it's typically, you can do it two different ways. You can get a tax credit at the end of the year, although everybody that I signed up, and I got to believe 98% of people, choose that the tax credit is applied monthly to the premium. So once someone successfully signs up for ACA coverage and has a tax credit, they will have a portion that they need to pay each month to the insurance company, and the federal government will pay the additional and the larger portion depending upon what percent of where they fall within the modified adjusted gross income. The lower it is, the more the tax subsidy is, and we call it a tax subsidy, but whether people have taxes or not, it's really a credit. And when you're getting close to 400%, there's a very modest benefit, still helpful, but a lesser benefit. Another very important part of the access to medical insurance is the additional cost-sharing reduction that occurs for if a person has a MAGI under 250%, then if they request a silver plan, again, it does not apply to bronze, platinum, or gold plans, but if someone requests a silver plan, not only will they get the tax subsidy that they're eligible for, but they'll also get a reduction of all the cost sharing. So you'll find that initially where it might have been a $2,000 deductible, that'll come down to $200 possibly. All cost sharing expenses go down very substantially. It might be if someone's at 100% of the federal poverty level, their expenses for the year will probably be no greater than $400 in the year. The rest will be supported both by the tax credit for the premium, but also the narrowing of all the cost pays and deductibles. But it only applies to silver plans. So if you have anybody who is earning, her MAGI is less than 250%, you need to check the silver plans and not go to the others, because that's where you'll see this very beneficial added benefit. The employer mandate is the third prong trying to get everybody covered here in America, most people covered in America. And the employer mandate was delayed, but is now actually being triggered for 2015, and it's being phased in. For the first year, for 2015, businesses with 100 or more full-time equivalent employees are subject to what they're calling a shared responsibility payment. Now, how you determine who's a full-time equivalent employee has got two different prongs in that. One is every employee who works 30 hours or more is considered full-time. And in addition to that, if you have a lot of part-time individuals and a business has a lot of part-time, you total up all part-time hours and you divide it by 30 to determine how many additional full-time equivalent employees are there. And I think the purpose of this was to prevent businesses from reducing everybody's hours to part-time and therefore slipping under 100 full-time equivalent employees. So for businesses with 50 to 99 full-time equivalent employees, their requirements under the statute are delayed till 2016. So for businesses with 100 or more FTE employees, they're obligated to offer affordable health insurance or pay a penalty. And affordable health insurance includes two different parts. the first part is it has to be equivalent at least to a bronze level of coverage, similar to the ACA coverages that are on the marketplace. The insurance has to have that at least 60% or more is covered by the insurance, and 40% or less is borne by the employee insured. That's one of the requirements. The second requirement is that the employer does have to subsidize this, because employees should not pay more than 9.5% of their household income for employee coverage, not for household coverage, but for employee coverage. And how do businesses know their employees' household income, you know, which might be a spouse, there may not be, there may be other children who are earners in the household. Who knows that? So what there's a safe harbor, and the safe harbor, which makes sense, is that the employee should not pay more than 9.5% of their own personal wages or income for the particular business. So depending on if there's an employer with a lot of basic wages, people are getting minimum wages, they may have to pay more of their insurance coverage than high earners in order to avoid this 9.5% issue. The failure to pay, the employer, there's two potential penalties for failing to pay. If the employer fails to offer insurance, their responsibility is $2,000 for each full-time equivalent employee minus 30. So, for example, if there was 100 full-time equivalent employees, and that's why they were triggered into this employer mandate, and the employer did not offer insurance, period, or offer maybe just offered catastrophic, but did not offer a bronze plan or an equivalent bronze plan, then that employer would have 2,000 times 100 employees minus 30, so 2,000 times 70, that would be a $140,000 fine. And that is not tax deductible. Paying for insurance is tax deductible. The paying for the penalty for failing to offer insurance is not tax deductible. The second penalty deals with, say the employer offers insurance, but some of the employees are paying more than 9.5% of their household income. That should be 9.5, not 9.5. But anyhow, if there is any employee who's paying more than 9.5% of their income to purchase the insurance from the employer, that employee can go to the exchange and get a tax credit. And for every employee that does go to the exchange and get a tax credit, the employer has a $3,000 fine. Not to be higher than the fine that they would have had if they didn't offer insurance to begin with. So anyhow, those are the two prongs, and now what we're here to talk about today. And today is the third prong, which is expanding Medicaid. And the purpose of that was to take the lowest income individuals, those making under 133 or in effect 138% of the federal poverty level, and expanding Medicaid to those individuals. And as you probably all know, the ACA required a mandatory expansion of Medicaid. But the National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius, the Supreme Court in majority decision in 2012, said that the mandatory Medicaid was unconstitutionally coercive of states. But said that they didn't have to throw out the statute. This could be remedied by just limiting the enforcement. By the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. So that's why the way it's approached now is that states have the option to expand their Medicaid programs. How that works is you would think the option would be quite inviting, because between 2014, this is the first year of expansion, through 2016, the Fed pays 100% of the costs of the expanded Medicaid program. And I shouldn't say of the cost of the enrollees, because there may be administrative costs, and that's part of Maine's problem, I guess, that there are some hidden costs there. But in regard to, whereas normally in most of our Medicaid can, the federal government might pay somewhere between 50 and 60%, and states pay typically 30 to 40 to 50%, depending on the states. Here, the feds are saying, for this expanded Medicaid group, we will pick up 100%. And gradually, starting in 2017, it decreases where it stays at 90% from 2020 onward. Expanded Medicaid would apply to individuals aged 19 to 64. The income limit, technically is 133%, but whereas now in traditional Medicaid we have the state disregard, the federal disregard, we can have a working disregard and all that sort of stuff, here they just have a simple 5% disregard. So in effect, the income limit is 138%. There is no asset test in expanded Medicaid. And up to November, 28 states and the District of Columbia have implemented Medicaid expansion for 2014. Really, now Maine is one of the 28 states, one of the remaining states that have not adopted Medicaid expansion. So this was quite fascinating to learn a bit about the laws as it relates to Medicaid expansion. So states have, most important thing, and I was unaware of that at least, is states have the flexibility to determine what benefits to offer to this newly eligible population group. The term they're using, and I'm going to go into this in a slide after this, is the alternative benefit plan, which is an extension of Section 1937 of the Social Security Act, which was passed in 2005 as part of a Deficit Reduction Act. So the expanded Medicaid can differ from traditional Medicaid, and it can differ for groups of newly eligible individuals. They can have one group getting certain coverage and another group getting certain coverage. And the goal was for states to look at their population and the demographics of their population and the cost to determine what benefits they wanted to offer. So, for example, Colorado did an analysis of who signed up for their expanded Medicaid and found that as compared to the general population, the newly eligible group was younger, less educated, but had worse health than the general population. So Colorado decided to model their ABP, Alternative Benefit Plan, for traditional Medicaid. But they are collecting data, and they're going to review and revise. So the point being that even if your state, most states have adopted their traditional Medicaid and then made the required changes to it, it doesn't have to stay that way. There are many states, I've got several articles about all sorts of states looking at it, and most adopted the traditional Medicaid for ease of transition. It was going to be hard enough to figure out everything, much less to create a different plan. But that's the initial beginning. Any year, they can put a state amendment in and alter their ABP and change the benefits. Give me one sec. States are limited by Section 1937. So this Section 1937 was actually enacted in 2005. Up to that point, all Medicaids were very based on a lot of formulas and a lot of specific requirements that Medicaid had. Medicaid had, this is what you need to do with prescriptions. This is what you need to do with hospitalization. It had all sorts of mandates. And in the DRA of 2005, they gave states options. They said you can offer traditional Medicaid, so this is way before ACA, or you can alter your Medicaid plan based upon these four choices. One was they could look to the standard Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO offered through the Federal Employees Health Program. They could look at each state could look at their own state employee coverage to see what was available. Or they could look at the commercial HMO with the largest insured non-Medicaid enrollment in the state. And finally was the secretary-approved coverage, which is traditionally the Medicaid state plan. So since 2006, most states have kept with the traditional state plan, but some did not. Some actually modified their Medicaid plan under one of these choices. There's actually a fifth choice here, that's called a benchmark equivalent choice. And what that is you would take the costs of one of these coverages and you would have it actuarially similar, but you could create your whole plan differently. So you might say, I'm going to provide more for this type of benefit than this benefit, even though actuarially they have to pay out the same amount. So there are really five choices that have been in existence since 2005. Only a few states change their traditional Medicaid. But now with this, now all of these benchmarks are called alternative benefit plans. So now each state and most, like for example, New Mexico, Arkansas, and West Virginia all have, those three states have a different, their alternative benefit plans that they offer to their newly eligible are different than their traditional Medicaid plans. And other states may be growing into this. in addition to those Section 1937 choices, the choices we gave up there, there are certain other criteria that have to be in the expanded Medicaid group, not necessarily the traditional Medicaid group. One is that all states with their ABP, if it's their traditional Medicaid, when they moved it over to the expanded group, they had to add the 10 essential health benefits to the extent they were not there already. And habilitative services is something new. So your traditional Medicaid may not have as much or similar habilitative services than you will find in the newly eligible alternative benefit plan that's being offered to low-income MAGI individuals. Another important point is the Parity Act. So in 2008, the Mental Health Parity Act required insurers to have similar copays and deductibles and limitations that are applicable to regular medical surgical benefits had to be applicable to mental health or substance use disorders. So that parity is required in the alternative benefit plan that's now offered to these newly eligible MAGI group, and not in the that parity is not in traditional Medicaid. So again, there may be a difference in services. The early periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment services for under 21, that is in traditional Medicaid as well as in the alternative benefit plan. But even if your state kept its traditional Medicaid, which it has to for those eligible under that prong, and adopted that also for the alternative benefit plan, they had to add these services. And your alternative benefit plan, they did not have to add it in traditional Medicaid. So you might have more behavioral and preventative and habilitation services and parity for substance use disorders in your alternative benefit plan for your MAGI individuals than you will have in your traditional Medicaid. The federal government was very concerned that states would push people into alternative benefit plans that are considered frail or that were medically needed and that they're categorically eligible under old Medicaid. So what they say is certain populations, and this I'm looking at slide 11, are exempt from mandatory enrollment in an alternative benefit plan. And if you look at that, that includes Medicare recipients, nursing home, blind or disabled. So if a state, such as New Mexico, if a state did not adopt traditional Medicaid into their alternative benefit plan, but it chose one of these other choices they had, these other benchmark choices, then those states have to give options to every person meeting every group, exempt group, meeting the criteria in 440.315, that's code of federal regulations. They have to give those group of individuals a choice. They have to make sure they inform them that you can choose ABP or you can choose traditional Medicaid, and they have to let them disenroll if they originally choose ABP. They have to permit them to disenroll, and they have to inform them of the differences between the two plans. So Benji probably won't see that in his state because his state adopted their traditional Medicaid plan as part of their ABP for the newly eligible group. But for those that didn't, such as Arkansas, West Virginia, New Mexico, there may be other states. And what I have done is I've included in helpful articles, and I think I actually included this in let me just see if I have it on the site. I didn't include it on the site, but I included in the helpful articles. I've got a article. It's not an article. It's actually by the state forum, and it's got a list of every state, whether they've accepted expanded Medicaid or not, and if they did, whether they adopted it on traditional Medicaid or whether they adopted one of these others. So you could look up your particular state and determine, do you have the same program in either for the MAGI group and for the traditional Medicaid, or is it different? So that might be helpful for each of you to look in your own particular state. Now, expanded Medicaid can include long-term care, long-term services and supports, and a lot of the states are including them. So again, this was optional. If they adopted as their alternative benefit plan, if they adopted as their MAGI group traditional Medicaid, along with that came all the long-term care services and supports that were in traditional Medicaid into their new program, insurance program for their newly enrolled enrollees on the MAGI formula. In addition to that, they added some, again, these requirements that they had to do. But because of that, there's a lot of confusion, because the critical thing is traditional Medicaid looks at assets. MAGI Medicaid, assets are not relevant. So there's been a lot of discussion. Does the state recovery apply? How does this apply to transfers and things like that? So CMS issued a letter to the state Medicaid directors, and I did include that in your uploaded that, or Gianna uploaded that into the SNA site. So this letter dated February 21st, 2014 from CMS was to the states trying to give them guidance as to how to deal with long-term services and the issues that arise in them in MAGI-related Medicaid eligibility. CMS was particularly concerned that state recovery rules could discourage enrollment. And they said they and that was one of the things they wanted to deal with. So they sent this letter out, and it's 6 pages, and it has a whole bunch of stuff in it, which is quite interesting. They go through an analysis as to determining when asset and transfer issues, the traditional issues that apply in traditional Medicaid, when they should apply for MAGI and when they shouldn't. And what they determined is that post-eligibility treatment of income rules, when the statute deals with that, they apply them to only discrete categories of individuals, basically institutionalized or those receiving waiver programs. So based on this analysis, and you'll have to read it, I can't explain it, I did understand it when reading it, but you'll have to read it yourself. Based on this analysis, they determined that MAGI individuals cannot have liens on their property. So people on traditional Medicaid, those states who have liens, for traditional Medicaid, they can keep, of course, having those liens, but for MAGI eligibility, no liens on property. They also say in this, which is quite interesting, I don't think this is happening out there, but in regard to post-eligibility income calculations, such as cost of cares for nursing home residents, residential care, cost of cares for residential services, no income requirements. That only applies to traditional Medicaid, not MAGI. I think, again, Benji will talk about this, and I don't think this is being applied. I think this is not being recognized, at least in Illinois. But what CMS's position is that there is no income requirement for MAGI-related long-term care services. They didn't like that, and they feel CMS said that they're considering creating rules to adopt an income limit to MAGI, but right now didn't apply to it. Estate recovery was another area that they focused on, and this letter focuses on. Oops, okay, that's good. I lost my slide for a sec. For estate recovery, what they concluded, they went back and forth, but what they concluded was for MAGI individuals that's receiving services for 55 years or older, state recovery does apply to them. CMS doesn't like that. They intends to thoroughly explore options and use unavailable authorities to eliminate estate recovery for all benefits other than long-term care services. But currently under the under how they analyze the statute, state recovery does apply to MAGI, which is odd. If your assets don't matter and they're trying to encourage people to become eligible for Medicaid, and most people aren't realizing that if they're 55 years or older, they're going to get tagged even though their assets didn't matter during life. So they're encouraging people, and I do understand at least 2 states, Washington and I think another state actually, I can't remember which one it is, dropped their estate recovery program because they said they're not going to apply it differently to MAGI and traditional. And CMS proposes to doesn't want states to enforce it against these individuals, but technically it does. How transfer penalties apply. Again, this whole analysis of whether it was post-eligibility income or not is a complicated analysis, but what they ultimately determined in this letter was CMS said that although assets do not matter for MAGI eligibility, transfers do matter. So transfer penalties for traditional Medicaid recipients apply to MAGI individuals. So, and how they looked at that is under ACA, assets are disregarded for eligibility. But under transfer penalties for institutionalization, that applies to a certain coverage, i.e. institutionalization, and that's why transfer penalties can occur. So if you are, if someone is eligible for a nursing home, is 60 years old, has income under 138% of the federal poverty level, they could have $400,000 and be eligible for Medicaid, nursing home. But if they transfer it, they're going to be penalized. Interesting. Another they dealt with was annuities, promissory notes, life estates, and they concluded that the traditional Medicaid rules would apply. So the same annuities, promissory notes, and life estate rules that we, statutes that we have since 2005 and before that, they do apply to general MAGI eligibility. Trust rules also apply, and trust rules apply in the way that, again, doesn't matter what the assets are, but if there's been a transfer to a trust, within the 5 years, you apply the traditional Medicaid rules for trust rules as it relates to transfers. Home equity limitation. After a pretty detailed analysis, CMS concluded that states must deny long-term care services to MAGI individuals whose home equity exceeds the limit consistent with traditional Medicaid, though assets aren't supposed to matter. So assets don't matter. You could have $800,000 in a bank account, doesn't matter, but if your home is more than $800,000 and you don't have a spouse there, you're not exempt in any other way, then you're ineligible for MAGI long-term care services. And it was just the way the statutes connected that they concluded that. So that's really a worthwhile letter for people to dig through and just look at how CMS is dealing with these. Last couple of points is MAGI really focuses on income, and the issues in there deal with MAGI, Affordable Care Act, traditional insurance offered on the exchange. They look at annual income. But MAGI Medicaid eligibility still looks at monthly income. So if somebody does have a stock that gets cashed in and you see capital gains, it would relate to that particular month but not other months of eligibility. Another point just to bring up is the manipulation of income. If, say, you have a disabled person but you want that person is eligible for traditional Medicaid but you want to keep them on MAGI Medicaid, you may want to manipulate income in a way so that they may be over the traditional Medicaid limit, if that's possible, and yet under the MAGI eligibility. One interesting point here I had with affordable dealing with exchange coverage, I had a client who had a who we applied for exchange, had no insurance, we needed to get it, but really had no income. Well, there was a third-party trust, And I said, well, we'll increase the distribution from the third-party trust to $1,100 a month to put them over the 100% federal poverty level. And the affordable care, the people on the phone said, fine, even though it wasn't income. If this was principal going out, they said, fine, we'll treat it as income. And he's been eligible for ACA exchange coverage now for, this is just going on a second year, based upon a manipulation of a third-party trust, even though technically it wasn't income. Now, will that come back to haunt him this year when they get his tax return? I'm not sure, because he will not have income, maybe a few hundred dollars, but nothing like that. But I think they were helpful. People are trying to find coverage versus not trying to exclude coverage. One other point for Maine, so all of this is in theory to me, because Maine is not an expansion state. Maine, 5 times was it offered to the governor last year, and 5 times did he veto it. And our governor was chosen again for another 4 years. But anyhow, but we still have these two sets of groups. So now we have it for the MAGI applies to women, children, parents, and guardians of children, pregnant women, I should say, and traditional Medicaid rules are for disability and elderly. So if you're disabled or elderly, you have to have under $10,000. But if you're a 19 or 20-year-old or parents of children, you can have unlimited assets. Seems a little bit unfair, but that's the way it's kicked in here because we haven't adopted expanded Medicaid. Also, for those states that haven't adopted expanded Medicaid, the example I just gave you of trying to get that client over the 100% federal poverty level, if someone is making under 100% federal poverty level, there is no tax subsidies. There is no help through the exchange. And that's really a hole that exists in any state that has not accepted expanded Medicaid. And I'm not going to go. I'm going to give this to Benji. I just was letting you guys know of Mayhew versus Burrell, which is a state that came down a first court of appeals that may be going to the Supreme Court. And it's because Maine, again, we not only have not expanded Medicaid, we have adopted retracted Medicaid. And this is we had all sorts of cuts in Medicare saving plans in a number of different areas. And this one particular cut was disapproved because of the maintenance of effort provision in the ACA. And now it's one other very interesting point. The Maine governor brought this appeal. The Maine attorney general is Democratic. The Maine Republican governor refused to bring the appeal. So she actually, the attorney general, intervened against this appeal, and Maine state hired its own private attorney to process this appeal. So we have even Maine attorney general and the governor battling each other about retracted Medicaid here in Maine.
Yeah, almost as dysfunctional as Illinois, but definitely can't. But you know, I don't think anyone can come close to that. So I guess I'm now going to switch over to my PowerPoint, talking about Illinois. All right. Everyone can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. So Illinois did expand Medicaid basically soon, you know, so right after 1/1/14, the expanded Medicaid, took off. And basically it's continuing on until they realize there's a lot of questions that are going on, and we're going to talk about with who's going to be paying. We have that 100% goes down to 90% reimbursement rate. Who actually pays when a state chooses to do expanded Medicaid? Do their alternative benefits plan includes all of the traditional Medicaid, what traditional Medicaid pays for, and they're paying $180,000, $200,000 a year potentially for each individual with IDD, and the feds are picking up 100% of that tab. Is that really how it's supposed to work? And there's argument about whether it's supposed to be half and half. Sorry? Okay. All right. There's questions about what's going to happen in the near future and the more long-term future about if things are going to change or not. But it's a huge difference because there's no acid test for newly eligible. So, again, unlike Maine, we did expand Medicaid. What's really interesting of how they worked it is that they basically threw everyone into expanded Medicaid. So when we have our clients who are applying, child's turning 18, they have intellectual developmental disabilities in most cases, and they're going to apply for Medicaid, they're getting thrown into expanded Medicaid category. Even though they are disabled and they would fit in the old disabled category, they get put into the expanded Medicaid, the newly eligible category, which means they don't have an asset test. But there are some unintended consequences of this, that they aren't using categories for those with disabilities when they first apply for Medicaid, and they're thrown into this kind of bucket with the expanded Medicaid. One of them is that Medicaid offices have begun asking about whether parents claim their adult disabled child as a dependent, and have started rejecting their application if they do. Because, under MAGI, parents' income can be included if the parents claim the child as a dependent. At least that's the way that Medicaid offices in Illinois are interpreting it, and so this has become a real problem. The ARC of Illinois has been working to fix this along with many other people that we work with and trying to quote-unquote fix this issue. There's a lot of these things where I sometimes question, we're going to fix that, and it's like, well, can you? you have the power to really fix that just through rewriting your rules and even your regs. You even have that power legislatively. So there's a lot of things here that I think that are real quirks in the legislation that because it was passed in a manner where they weren't able to kind of go through the normal process with the conference committee and kind of clean up the bill, that there's a lot of things where I think that's where we're running into these things. But so parents are being told that their child is eligible for Medicaid even with their assets over $2,000 in their name, but so it's another issue because they're not being told that, oh, by the way, that may not be the case in the future, and also there's a transfer penalty in the future, too, if they're looking for long-term support services like group homes. So that's become, you know, another big issue. One thing that we are seeing again and again on the, not actually implemented, but, you know, and actually touched on it, is that there's a lot of, that the concept of, well, you get a small allocation of the Social Security amount if someone's living in a group home or an intermediate care facility or skilled nursing care, they have that, you know, $50 a month, $60 a month, depends on the state what that number is all they get to keep, and the rest goes to the agency. Well, to reduce what the state has to pay through Medicaid. But under the ACA, under expanded Medicaid, the way that it's been interpreted, and that Medicaid offices are at least have been mentioning this, even though it hasn't been implemented yet, is that the individual should be keeping all of their Social Security money, sounds great. Just Medicaid's going to pay more, and that's all going to get flowed through the 100% reimbursement from the Fed. So it's a big party. But there's the issue of, well, is that really the case? And if it is, okay, great. Now these individuals can start saving their Social Security money. But we have the issue of, well, what if they get on, as we're going to mention in a second, they get onto Medicare, and now they aren't eligible for expanded Medicaid anymore, and now they do have this issue of this money in their name, and they have an asset test, and so there's a lot of potential pitfalls here. And so that's why I call them my next slide, traps for the unwary. So the ACA expanded Medicaid eliminates the asset test, but only if the child or the individual, in this case we're talking about disabilities, is under 65. Or until they turn 65. The day they turn 65, they're no longer eligible for expanded Medicaid, but they're still living in that group home. They need the Medicaid to still pay for it, and now their asset test is reapplied. And so now maybe that what we just talked about is happening, and they're starting to accumulate, you know, over $1,000 a month. Social Security starts going into their account, and they're accumulating because they don't really have that much in the way of expenses, and now they have $30,000 or $40,000. Oh, by the way, you're off Medicaid right now. And you're over 65, so you can't use a D4A, and you can't use a pooled trust lease in Illinois, and so, you know, good luck. So it's a real mess that is going to be on our hands in the future, because no one's educating families about this, and the Medicaid offices aren't doing that. And there's the issue of Medicare as well, because, and this is also a question some state about whether or not in the legislation it requires that if you're on Medicare you can't have expanded Medicaid. But the way certainly it's being implemented in Illinois, and in my understanding in other states that have done the full expansion where long-term support services are included in the expanded Medicaid, once you're on Medicare, you no longer are eligible for expanded Medicaid. So we have all these individuals, many of our clients, they go on to a parent's work record because mom or dad just turned 65 or 62, maybe start collecting Social Security early, or 66, whatever. They now get their Social Security check. Now their child goes on to their Social Security record, and then 24 months later, they're on Medicare themselves, the child. And now, you know, they're 30 years old, but they're on Medicare, and guess what? They're off of expanded Medicaid, and they're back to the old asset test. And now, you know, any assets they accumulated and didn't worry about, oh, guess what, now you have a problem. And so, you know, maybe the reason they went on Social Security is because the surviving parent passed away, and now there's no parent available to establish a D4A trust. We have to start dealing with a pool trust or maybe going to court and deal with the guardian. There's all kinds of reasons why this could become a real mess. And then the other thing that Patty talked about is this 5-year look back for transfers, which makes absolutely no sense. You can keep $10 million in your name, but the second you transfer it to someone else or you gift it to someone else, now it's a problem. And it makes no sense. Why are you asking about transfers when you don't care about assets? But they do, and that's the way that it's being enforced. There's a lot of these things that are coming up in Illinois. That just to be aware for those of you who don't have an expanded Medicaid yet, but think it might happen in the future, or at least have not expanded Medicaid to include long-term services and supports. And then I guess I'll finally conclude with, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions, you know, some concerns about the future and the, you know, things that are, you know, coming up on the horizon. At least in Illinois, we just have a newly elected Republican governor. We're not sure how he might impact the current Illinois expansion of Medicaid, whether he'll try to pull that back, although the Democrats have a veto-proof majority in the state legislature, so not sure how successful he would be if he tried to. And the other concerns, that at least that we have in Illinois, is, well, what if the federal government or Congress starts realizing that the states are shifting the cost 100% for long-term support services, which is an astronomical amount. And like I said, it could be for group home. Illinois is actually one of the lowest rates in the country, so it's $50,000 or $60,000. But if they're in an intermediate care facility, we're talking about $140,000, $150,000. And if they're in state institutions, like Illinois still has a bunch, we're talking about $240,000 plus a year. And the feds are paying 100%, not the normal 50% match. And that sounds like it's a huge deal. It's a great deal for the states, but there's a lot of concerns that eventually the feds might realize that, hey, maybe we aren't going to keep this going, and we're going to make the states start paying their share again, and then all of a sudden Illinois gets stuck with a huge bill. And by the way, Illinois has the lowest credit rating in the country. I don't know. I think we're lower than California, and have a massive, massive pension liability that is basically unserviceable. So it's a real scary proposition if all of a sudden they get hit with a huge bill in the future because of expanded Medicaid for long-term support services that the feds no longer do 100% reimbursement for. So anyways, that is, in a nutshell, what's going on with Illinois expanded Medicaid. And now I want to open it up for questions, comments about what's going on in your states to educate everyone else and so forth.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Lori. So for this transfer penalty, Minnesota's an expansion state, and we have not had, to my knowledge, the issue where a penalty has been applied. And so if someone applies and they're not applying for long-term care, they're just applying for the regular MAGI program, do they still look at transfers because long-term care is a potential, or
no? Only if the transfer penalties only come into existence for nursing home, though that might have increased to all long-term services.
It's all long-term service and supports, or at least all residential. So group homes are included in that. It's the same thing in traditional Medicaid. 5-year look back. If you wanted a group home for the next 5 years, you still have that same 5-year look back. In this case, I think they're still applying it under expanded Medicaid in that same situation.
So you have a client who comes in and doesn't need long-term care at first, and then 6 months later becomes disabled. Will they then do another analysis? Or I'm having a hard time seeing how that's going to work, really.
I would definitely think that if they do need it 6 months later, they would be inside that 5 years, and they're going to say, well, did you transfer it out of their name? You're under the transfer penalty. Even though there's no acid test even to get into the skilled nursing care, assuming again they're part of expanded Medicaid under 65, they would still have a 5-year look back on transfers.
Wow. Has anybody who's listening run into that, like actually had a penalty? Or have you guys had a penalty imposed?
I know it's in the form that's filled out. If you're going to actually go into apply for skilled nursing, I know it's in that form even under expanded Medicaid. But I've never seen it actually enforced yet. I mean, it's pretty new.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
For us as practitioners, for those in expanded states, or just in case your Maine again is not expanded but could, if someone doesn't need a special needs trust, because assets do not matter, it may be better to put them into maybe a settlement protection trust for their benefit, and only convert it to a special needs trust if they have to go on traditional Medicaid. And that's because it's because sometimes people say, well, I'll put them on first of all, if they're on expanded Medicaid, because of the payback provision, if it's a self-settled trust, because of the payback provision, you may be having to pay back even though you wouldn't have to in any other reason under expanded Medicaid. But also, every state in the country has some level of managed care in their Medicaid programs. Maine limits it. We have a limited, it's really most for long-term care, and it's just a capitated rate. But in many states, there's actually, for their general community Medicaid, there's a capitated rate. So I think I was reading in California or something, or it was, sorry, I read a lot for this, and I don't keep it all, but in California, it might have been about $3,000, or it might have been the state of Washington, $3,000 per community member. So even if you're thinking you have a beneficiary who has traditional insurance from their parent and are only relying on a little bit of Medicaid or very little, you might have if it's a $4,000 a month, you're going to have a $4,000 payment per month to repay whether they used any services or not. So even if you had somebody on Medicaid and they die after 5 years and they didn't use services, you had it there just in case, you're paying 4,000 times 12, 48,000 times 5, almost a $250,000 payment for very little services, because capitated Medicaid reimbursement doesn't matter about the services. It just matters the amount per person that's being charged for their general community Medicaid. So, and even in my state that might not have it, I may be going to another state that does have it, and my client might move. So I'm really looking at more only triggering that special needs trust provision, the D4A special needs trust provision, if they're needing to rely on Medicaid now and not thinking, well, we'll put it in now and in the future when they need it, at least it's settled. We may want to create it in case a parent dies, but maybe not want to fund it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there's you look at, in our state, the situation would be the second that they get onto Medicare, they no longer are even eligible for expanded Medicaid. They're back to the traditional Medicaid rules anyways. We're in a state, it's one of the few states that has a law that says that a child can stay on a parent's health insurance forever if they're deemed disabled by. And so then, for most of our clients, they're not on Medicaid for insurance. They have insurance, and they can stay on, the parent, as long as they're still working, there's going to be insurance that the child could stay on, even if the child's 35 or 40, doesn't matter. So it's actually one of the few things that Illinois is really good about. They have the Medicaid for the long-term support services, and services and supports, and so therefore, they're the second that they get on the Medicare on the parent's work record, you get a Social Security on the parent's work record, then you get on the Medicare 24 months later, now all of a sudden assets count again. You have to basically make sure that you're ready for that situation. So maybe having a D4A already established, ready to go for the assets to be transferred into when needed. Any other questions, comments, thoughts about your states or their observations? All right, I'm not hearing any. Patty, do you have any other final thoughts you want to talk about?
No, not really. Wish everybody a happy and healthy holiday season. And hopefully this was helpful. For me, it was a very good learning experience, since we don't have expanded Medicaid, trying to understand everything out there. I will reference, there was one other, it's a manual, it's called the Advocate's Guide to Magi, and I thought it was very helpful to understand Magi and the difference of Magi in ACA coverage and Medicaid and the family composition issues. Just trying to see if put an email to the SNA and just include this reference if anybody wants to look at it. It's put together by the National Health Law Program, policy analysis, and two attorneys, and updated as of February 2014. But I thought it very, very good in understanding the different points of Magi, both because they said one of the issues is how income is defined, but the other very big issue is, as you were just explaining a little earlier, Benji, is how family composition is defined. And and looks like Illinois are trying to deny children who are counted as dependents. This gets into that and other issues. So I think it might be helpful for people to review this. So I will include this there.
Great.
Okay, well, thank
you. All right. Take care, everyone. Happy holidays.
Bye, Benji. Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thank you.